Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which changed their life forever. By talking about the things they wish they'd known, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things. And we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. Today I'm speaking to Lauren, who's been sober for 11 and a half years. We're talking about her experience of addiction and sobriety. This conversation with Lauren has really challenged my own views of addiction. So, Lauren, how did you first get introduced to drugs?
The first drug that caused me problems was definitely alcohol. And I started drinking when I was probably around 13. And I know that these days for a 13-year-old to walk into a shop and buy alcohol is virtually impossible because they've got all kinds of rules about ID and stuff. Wasn't so much the case. It was still illegal. But people turned a blind eye to kids buying alcohol when I was younger. So it was easier to access. It was expensive. So I had to, you know, couldn't afford to buy too much. But I could get my hands on alcohol quite early. And my group of friends were really into drinking. And I grew up in South London and we'd go to the park and we'd drink and someone throwing up or blacking out was kind of, someone did it every time. So it wasn't sort of frowned upon so much. It became frowned upon as I got older. But drinking was really big. And I, as a person who struggled with social anxiety, would turn up somewhere, was desperate to be liked, desperate to be popular, found drinking to be like quite a good crutch to sort of just cut me off from that kind of anxiety and that worry and just give me what I felt at the time was a bit of freedom to kind of just enjoy myself and feel looser. And I carried on drinking and I was always like one of the heavier drinkers. And I carried on drinking quite heavily all through university and things like that. And university is also what an environment to drink a lot. It's so encouraged, like 50p shots, come out for these drinks, you know, come to these bar crawls. And at the time, even though I'd been raised going to church, I didn't have an active faith. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't praying or trying to bring Jesus into my decision making. I was just doing whatever felt okay at the time. So I actually was introduced to illegal drugs, which then just opened up a whole nother level of problems for me. When I was 22, which is old for many people when it comes to sort of dabbling with things, like I'd smoked some cannabis before that and I was around drugs, but I first took cocaine when I was 22 and I was offered it at a party and I'd said no a few times before. But actually like cocaine meant that I could drink more. And I really wanted to drink more. And it puts in a sort of protective layer for you chemically so that you don't end up blacking out or vomiting from alcohol. So it means that you can drink a lot more alcohol, which was a win for me as a person who absolutely loved to drink alcohol. But also it came with, from my perspective, kind of a lifestyle that I wanted. It was the people around me who were using it, I saw to be quite fabulous, quite wealthy, you know, popular. And popularity was always key for me. I wanted to be liked. So if everyone else was doing it and the people I admired were doing it, I was going to be doing it. But things went wrong for me quite quickly.
I was going to add, like, you quite often hear stories of celebrities doing it and that kind of celebrity culture with it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And they'll be surrounded. The people who offered it to them will be people who they admire, people who are in some sort of power, influence, maybe already famous themselves. It just gets baked into the culture around you to the point where you're like, well, I want to be, everyone wants to be a part of, everyone wants to be on the inside. And the circle I was in to be on the inside was cocaine.
For me, it's quite a far way from my experience growing up, but maybe less so with the alcohol. Like, because I feel we live in a society where we're quite encouraged to drink.
Massive.
And I've got friends who, for different reasons, have made decisions to not drink.
Mm.
And there's always, or they might go to an event and they decide not to.
Mm.
And the next question is, well, why aren't you drinking?
Yeah.
So it must be quite hard to not end up drinking.
It's so funny. The culture's changed a bit I'd say recently, when I first got sober, which I'm sure we'll come to.
Yeah,
I got sober 11 years ago. And if you looked around online for influencers, for support, for things like that, there was one person really vocal about sobriety, and that was Russell Brand, who's obviously a very polarizing character anyway, for many, many reasons, and particularly recently. But he was the only person I really heard being really honest and open about it, even though there are other celebrities who are sober, but they didn't speak so openly. Whereas these days, it's, you know, if you just search on Instagram or TikTok, there are these whole movements of people, particularly young people, people who are around 20, who for various reasons, and sometimes that's because they were drinking alcoholically and it was a problem and it did amount to an addiction. Sometimes just social anxiety. Sometimes I just don't want to. And then you've got people who want to drive or have decided that for religious reasons, it's not right for them, or are pregnant. And actually, we don't need to be asking people questions. You don't have to make someone confess that they're on antibiotics in a bar, you know. And I think for a long time there was that, well, why aren't you drinking? And I would order like a slimline tonic and someone would be like, gin and tonic. And I'm like, no, slimline tonic. And they're like, no gin. Why no gin? And you're like, come on, give me a break here. But increasingly people are a bit more aware. Not always, but a little bit these days.
Well, that's a positive sign.
I think so.
So going back to your addiction, were there any like physical signs of what addiction was doing in your life?
Definitely. And actually, I think I didn't really understand them at the time, but I've gone on to understand them a bit better. The majority of the physical symptoms I had from using were a result of alcohol. Alcohol is incredibly damaging to you physically. And the amount that I was drinking facilitated by cocaine meant that I was having things like memory loss. I got numbness in my fingers and toes. I got sort of these spots in front of my eyes, which is nervous damage behind your eyes. And I got a twitch sometimes when I started drinking. And, you know, bearing in mind, all of this is in aid of popularity. So I'm in social settings and suddenly my face starts twitching, which is like absolutely not what you want when you're just trying to be liked and as fabulous as possible. And suddenly you have to sort of hide yourself away. And then I did get nosebleeds, and that is definitely a direct result of cocaine use. And we're seeing more of that. Just you know, the week that we're recording, Paris Jackson, Michael Jackson's daughter, came out on TikTok to say that she's got a hole in her septum from cocaine use. And she's now on a recovery journey, which hopefully will last forever. But so you can do some real damage to your nose, for sure. I didn't get to that point, but I know that it happens like more often than you'd realize.
How did that impact your life? And I mean that in terms of, were you able to work? Mm. Were you able to like keep being popular and socialize?
Mm. I did carry on working, but I was late. I was sloppy. I wasn't performing very well. And it was definitely noted. But my working environment was where I was introduced to the drugs. I was working in events and marketing for a group of restaurants, hospitality. It's a very sort of work hard, play hard industry. So they were used to it to an extent. It was accepted maybe more than it would have been in some other industries. So I got a little bit further. Socially, though, it started to cause real problems. My friends started to get really fed up with me. And outside of my work friends, my friends who I'd been friends with from school or from university, they didn't take drugs and they drank, and we would go out and, you know, go to the pub and things like that. But in a far more, I mean, what's normal, but in a far more socially acceptable way. So I started to cause problems on nights out. I would disappear. I'd go off to pick up drugs. I would be very difficult. I would never want to go home. I'd always encourage them to keep drinking and keep staying out so that I would have company. And people got really sick of me. And people did pull me up on my behavior. I lost friends over it, for sure.
What was the moment that you realized you'd gone too far?
Yeah, that's so funny. Addicts talk about a rock bottom all the time, and that's like the moment that switched. But sadly, every rock bottom does have a trapdoor, which is what they say as well. So like, you can think you've got there, and then you're like, oh no, there's more humiliation available to me before I make an actual life-changing decision. I guess there are a few moments that really stick with me. I think the one that sticks with me most is I had said I was only going to have one drink, and I'd gone out with a friend for one drink, and then she had gone home after that one drink, and I had come home at 4 a.m. and I was an absolute mess, and I didn't really remember where I'd been or what I'd been doing. And she came bursting through the door that morning, because we lived together. She came bursting through the door into my room and said, like, absolutely not. You know, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to be supporting you whilst you make these declarations and make these decisions that you're not going to do things that you end up doing. And I can't be your friend like this. And she used language that I won't use. But she was angry. She was angry. And then I, that morning, I was supposed to be going off on holiday. So I went off on holiday, just managed to make, you know, my train and then flight after that and all of that kind of stuff. So I got back maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, and she sat me down then and she said, I've looked into it. And so I issued an apology when I got back, and we're okay. But she said, I've looked into support group meetings and I want you to go to this one. And she had one in mind that she had selected for me. And I said I would go, and it took me a few weeks, but I did eventually go.
What a good friend.
Yeah, she is a good friend. She is a good friend.
Because also, like, I can, because you talked before about losing friends. Mm. And I can kind of understand that they needed to put their own boundaries in and protect themselves as well. But that friend sounds like a real good friend for you.
Yeah, she was. She's amazing.
Did at any point the heavy drinking and doing the drugs, like, make you feel better short term? Was that, like, part of the reason why you kept doing it? Was it, like, you got a buzz? Or maybe a buzz isn't the right word for it, but...
Yeah. Drugs are, like, absolutely phenomenal tools. Like, they offer reasonably unparalleled protection from your pain and your emotions in the short term. You know, like, obviously, knowing what I know now... that is not an easy fix, is no fix at all, right? But with so few tools at my disposal at the time to process anything that I was going through, like, I do not feel at all bad for having made that choice with what I had at the time. I'm very sad for myself, and I would do anything I could to stop somebody else making that choice because of the implications and the knock-on effect down the road. But I was hurting for a number of reasons, and I didn't have a therapist. I didn't understand how I was feeling. I was very young. I didn't have a faith or a sort of active relationship with Jesus. I didn't know that if I invested in myself long term, it wouldn't be an immediate answer, but it would bring peace that I needed down the line. So actually, you know, drugs and alcohol were my solution rather than my problem. They were firefighters to help me get through fire. And and they were incredibly effective, but also ineffective in the long term.
Yeah, I guess they also were your solution, but also the long building to the problem in the longer term as well.
Well, no, they were a solution to the problem, but they brought their own problems. So they didn't change or exacerbate any of the original problems, but they just lumped on some new ones, which makes dealing with any problem harder because you're suddenly drowning in, like, more problems. Yeah. Yeah. So it all just becomes totally unmanageable. I think when I see that somebody's in the early days of sobriety, actually what you're saying is this is a person who for one reason or another needed a crutch, right? Needed to turn to alcohol, drugs, or some other behavior that has caused them damage. They needed something, distraction or support or something. And that's what they turned to. wrongly for sure, but that's what they turn to. So the person with a problem, they've lumped a whole load more problems on themselves. They've got a dependence. They probably have very low emotional understanding of themselves, virtually no tools to solve that problem. They've probably alienated themselves from the people in their lives around them, their friends, their family. They've created this massive bin fire of their life. And then on that first day, you're saying to that person, fix it. They've got nothing. It is genuinely an absolute miracle when somebody from that place, having created such a mess with like literally nothing in their hands to stoop down and start rebuilding with, manages to make that decision and stick to it. I see Jesus in that every time. I'm like, I cannot believe that you have achieved effectively the impossible when you manage to do that. And I think that the only reason people are able to do that is because often because they have support and they're not doing it on their own. I think to do it on your own is like impossible, really.
So what led to you having that moment, reaching up and pulling yourself out, I guess?
Well, that was my friend sending me to the recovery meeting. So then I turned up there and it was a drug support meeting, which is usually like full of men. If we were to like walk into any sort of drug support meeting in London where we're recording now, it probably the demographic would be like 2/3 men and often quite a bit older than I was at the time. I was 25. But by the grace of God, I walked into a room of women in their 20s. And that's never happened to me since, like at any meeting I've gone to. But it was just women in their 20s. There was one woman who had 4 years sobriety, but most of them were about 3 months. So it was just within reach what they were achieving. And they were so supportive and so helpful. And they answered every stupid question I had. Just with kindness and understanding. And they talked in a way that was so relatable for me, but I'd never heard anyone else speak like that, you know, having not been around people with addiction problems. And it just felt like, it just felt so freeing and hopeful. And it was then I called my sister, in the sort of prodigal story, I'm the one who was wild and went away. And my sister like stayed in church the whole time. And I called her and I said, I'm thinking about stopping drinking. She knew I was trying to stop taking drugs, but I was like, I think I might stop drinking. And she was like, you've got to do it. She's like, I think that'll be the proudest thing you've ever done. You've got to do it. And I made the decision then and there that I was going to try, you know, and that's not easy. And it was really white knuckling it for the first month or so. I was just like watching the clock, waiting for it to get to like 9 p.m. so I could go to bed. And I would have done it. I would have made it through a day. It felt like I was like in a race to get to the end of the day without drinking or taking drugs. And slowly that sort of intensity and that sort of like tightness in your chest kind of lifts and you realize like, okay, no, I'm doing this. And a big part of that for me was those support meetings, but also they said in those meetings, you need a higher power and it's not you. So work out what that is. And having had a mum who was Christian when I was younger, I walked into a church and I asked for prayer. And they really took me under their wing. So it was the combination of the two.
You preempted my next question, which was, how did faith become part of your recovery story?
Yeah, it was them saying, you know, if you're going to do this recovery journey, we think that you need a higher power. And I guess as a 25-year-old, so my first thing was like, right, I'll just Google church and see what's around and turn up somewhere and ask some questions. And then I probably, if that hadn't worked, probably would have been like a yoga instructor because that's literally what everyone does when they go into recovery. They suddenly do loads of yoga. But I didn't, I found community. I found support. I found a group of people who were incredibly patient with me when I had questions and was like, not aggressive, but probably a bit abrasive, you know, like I definitely had my guard up against religion and against the rules and what people were going to, you know, expect of me and judge me and all of that kind of stuff. And I think that was maybe a bit of a hangover from the 90s when church was a bit more like that at times, I think. I definitely experienced when I was younger in church, just feeling judged, just feeling that there was a standard of behavior that the Christians lived up to that I didn't, and that I was not good enough and was never going to be good enough for them. But I didn't get that second time around. I felt I was approached far more from a place of these guys are also wounded, but doing their best to heal themselves and those around them, rather than we're fine, so you should be too, which was really transformational for me.
Pope Francis, the late Pope, he had a quote of that the church is a hospital full of like broken people,
yeah,
rather than it's full of people who are like holy and perfect.
Yeah.
It's actually full of people who are wounded.
Exactly. And that was modeled far better second time round for me. It felt like I was, surrounded by people who were just doing their best to get well, rather than sort of like pious, like, you know, I've achieved it, here's what you need to do kind of thing.
So how was the process of going sober?
Gosh, everything in my life was built around alcohol and then later cocaine. When I was going to get it, how much I was going to get, when I would need it, how I'd maintain access, you know, just getting the balance of how much I used or drank right. The mental arithmetic of drug use is like absolutely unending. Working out the money, working out how you're going to get to a cash point, making sure you can pay for it. When are they coming? Who are you going to tell? How are you going to lie? You know, all of that kind of stuff. The manipulation is just constant, and it takes up so much of your headspace. And so much of your time is like either being drunk or high or hungover on a come down. So actually living sober, the days felt really long, and I had this space in my mind that I didn't know how to fill. So for a long time, anytime I walked somewhere, I counted my steps, because like my mind was used to being so full, and then suddenly that was gone and I just couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle the sort of peace or solitude or quiet or silence. So I had to fill it. So I just 1, 2, 3, 4 every time I walked anywhere. It's really quite excruciating to let go of something you rely on so heavily without a structure in place to replace it. And whilst I was building the structure through recovery and therapy and church, it wasn't actually built yet. It's like incredibly difficult. And it's just moments of hope, words of kindness, people, you know, just a smile, a little squeeze on the arm, you know, you've got this. Someone saying like, I felt that way too, you know, all of that just keeps you going. And it's very little to cling on to in the early days, but it is worth it. It is worth it. And working out how to, I mean, I thought I was swapping sort of, I say this quite a lot, but I thought I was swapping the misery of addiction for the misery of abstinence. So working out what a full life for a 25-year-old girl who is like so used to partying and things, what a full whole life looked like on the other side of that without those things, it took some time. It took some time for sure.
So you talked about how in those early days you had real challenges and you'd make it through the day and felt proud of that. But now, 11 and a half years later, do you still have those moments?
Mm. Yes and no. The struggle I have now with sobriety is different. I don't feel like I'm on the cusp of drinking. And I think that, but I wouldn't ever want to be complacent about that. I think that there would be 100 steps to a relapse. And sometimes I take 10 of them or 15 of them, you know. But I catch myself and I see, okay, that's an unhelpful thought pattern. Or why are you acting like that? Why are you, you know, why? And there are little triggers and little signs that I can see, like, okay, you're not doing so well at the moment. Like, let's regroup and get back on even keel. But that's still quite far off from the actual point where I pick up a drink or pick up some drugs. But there are things that get me, you know, and and life can hit. And I'd say last year, I, you know, had a family bereavement, and I broke up with a partner who I thought I was going to marry, and had quite a serious sort of like falling out with a friend that was really painful, you know, and stuff like that. And all of these things kind of came at the same time. And I really struggled. I really struggled with my mental health. And I had to be really straight up with some people around me and be like, you know, drinking would make this easier and I'm not going to do it. But like, you know, there's still that thought in the back of my mind, like, oh, maybe that's a way out. But I've got enough now. I've got enough information to know, you know, you play the tape all the way through and actually like, I don't want what's at the end of that tape. So there are many sort of healthy mechanisms, but it doesn't, I would never describe myself as recovered. You know, I'm recovering. I'm in recovery. When Paul talks about the thorn that he lives with in his side, that through Jesus, he is stronger with that debilitating, whatever it is, that's how I see myself, right? I'm not able to sit down and have a glass of wine with you, but I am, through the grace of God, able to move forward more strongly, more powerfully through him, despite the fact that I have something that causes me difficulty. And that's okay.
Well, we talked earlier about your friend, that you lost friends when you had, yeah, when you were addicted. Have any of those friends come back?
No. Hmm. No. The friends who challenged me on the behavior and gave me space to change. And some people did take little steps back and, oh no, I'm not coming out tonight and things like that. But they were still in my life, but in different ways. Those relationships have been renewed. But actually the people who made a conscious decision to cut me off, they actually haven't. And as part of the recovery process, I made amends. And that meant reaching out and apologizing to some people. And some people you don't reach out to because it may cause them more damage. If someone's explicitly said, I never want to hear from you again, to reach out to them to apologize, that's selfish. That's you doing that for you. So you find other ways to make amends to them. Maybe you write a letter that you never send, you know? And so there are a few people I did reach out to apologize. Some people said, thank you, I really appreciate that, but didn't want a sort of ongoing relationship. Some people completely ignored the message, and some people were so open-handed. I love this for you. I'm so pleased that you're moving forwards and things like that. So it was different. But actually the way that people respond cannot affect whether or not I'm going to do it, you know, because it's about cleaning your side of the street and doing what's right for you. But I'm definitely still sad about the hurt that I caused. For somebody to walk away, you've caused them pain. And I don't want to be a person who causes other people pain. So I just have to keep my distance and pray that they're doing well and they've got real good friendship around them, even if it can't be me.
And did you learn about yourself in that process?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because I hadn't done anything particularly introspective or reflective at all. But I worked the 12 Steps of Recovery, which is all about introspection. It's incredibly confronting, very painful, demands absolute honesty from me, from anyone. And I just wasn't in the habit of being honest with anyone, myself or those around me. So it was very difficult. And you work through that with like a mentor or a sponsor. So I learned a huge amount about myself through that. And that was I did that quite quickly. So over the sort of first year of recovery, I'd say the journey of learning about myself through Christ has been far longer, far slower. I never had like a lightning bolt moment. I never had like a, you know, you hear these stories like, I was just in bed and then I heard these words or I saw this thing and you're like, wow, that's amazing. That wasn't me. It wasn't like a boom and you're changed, you know, like, and I said that sort of salvation prayer that first day in church. They encouraged me to sort of repent and to accept Jesus in my life and all of that stuff. And I was baptized about a year and a half later. So I did the things that it was recommended I did, but I didn't instantly feel different at all. And for me, faith has been taking one small pigeon step at a time and then looking back after maybe 3 or 4 years and realizing like, oh, I've really traveled some distance. So day to day, the difference has been pretty unremarkable, pretty hard to distinguish. But over the course of years, it's like night and day.
That's really refreshing to hear, because quite often when you hear people's stories, it's always about that, like what I call boom moments. Like they have that big change in their life. They hear God speaking to them in the night. But actually, I think for majority of people, we do have that experience where we just take it day by day. And then we look back and go, wow, God was really present in my life over the last
year. I think it takes more faith. Because it's not like a defining, like, yes, you're getting this right. It's like, oh, I've just got to keep plugging away, doing what I hope and believe is right, you know, listening to wise counsel around me, praying, reading the Bible, and just, you know, pray that those changes, that my heart changes, my character changes in really positive ways. And it does, it always does. But without that, like, boom, sometimes you can really doubt yourself.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me because it made me rethink about the experience of people getting sober. There is so much in this episode that we're actually going to rejoin it again next week and hear more about Lauren's experience. You can find out more about this and other themes at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.